Matt, before we begin, good morning. It is approximately 10:15 a.m. on Tuesday, November 24th, 2020. This is a Public Service Commission meeting in the Public Service Commission hearing room on the 12th floor of the State Capitol, Bismarck, North Dakota. The purpose of this hearing is to conduct a public hearing on proposed changes to the Commission's administrative rules. If an interested person would like to provide remote input during the hearing, you can call 701-328-4081 to be placed on a list. We also have several individuals that have already signed up in advance to provide comments, I believe. But again, for those who haven't, you can call 701-328-4081. I am Commissioner Brian Crotchis, Chairman of the Public Service Commission. With me today are Commissioners Julie Fedorchak and Randy Christman. I don't have any opening comments. Commissioner Fedorchak?
I don't have any opening comments either. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Christman?
I do not. Thanks.
The rules case being heard today is case number PU-20-422. The purpose of this of the proposed amendments to Article 69-06 is to minimize impacts on intercontinental ballistic missile facilities, launch control facilities, and strategic defense operations. The proposed amendments also update noticed agencies, filing requirements, administration of siting fees, corridor width requirements, and clarify that an owner may waive having areas within 500 feet of a residence, school, or place of business as an avoidance area. The Commission has scheduled this public hearing to allow everyone the opportunity to submit information or comments concerning the adoption of proposed changes to the North Dakota Administrative Code. All comments received at this public hearing will be considered by the Commission, together with all other written comments received. Written comments may be submitted until the close of business on December 4th, 2020. The Public Service Commission will consider all comments received and address the comments in its written decision. Anyone may request a copy of the decision, and it will be provided via email or regular mail. The decision and all other filings in this case will also be available on the Commission's website, www.psc.nd.gov/. The hearing is being broadcast over the Internet and is also being electronically recorded. Everyone will be given the opportunity to speak. Please identify yourself for the record before you speak and speak slowly and clearly. If you have a prepared statement, a written copy of your statement is appreciated and will be helpful. Prior to opening up the hearing for comments, I'm going to now turn to Mr. Pat Fawn, who is on staff, to explain the changes. Pat, it's all yours.
Okay. As you noted, there are several proposed changes to administrative rules, the Commission's administrative rules. Under Administrative Code Article 6906, which pertains to energy conversion facilities and transmission facility siting. So I'll go through the changes as they're listed in our proposed rule change, starting from with the first one is a proposed change to Section 6906.0101, which is the definitions. And this is what I would consider a housekeeping change necessitated by the legislation that split the Siting Act under the North Dakota Century Code into two chapters. Those chapters are Chapter 49-22 and Chapter 49-22.1. The proposed change to our rules simply is for the definition of siting rules. And under that definition, now we're making reference to both Siting Act chapters 49-22 and 49-22.1. The second change is a proposed change to Section 6906.0105. And this is the section that designates the agencies and officers that are, that the Commission must give notice to, that are entitled to notice when we receive a siting application. And what this change does is update some of the names of the agencies, because some of those names have changed, and it adds a few names of designated agencies to the list. The next change is to section 6906.0106, which is the siting fee refund. And the purpose of the change is to simplify and clarify the timing for the refund of unused siting application fee funds that were provided by the applicant for processing the siting application. The proposed change also eliminates the minimum amount for which a refund will be issued. It used to be that we wouldn't, it said that we wouldn't issue refunds if it was less than $50, but we're removing that from that rule. The next proposed change is to section 6906.0202. And this is to do with the filings of an application. And this change would eliminate the requirement that 10 copies of the utility's 10-year plan must be filed with the commission. The next change is to section 6906.0401. Subsection 2, subsection N, related to the application contents. And these are the map and GIS requirements that they're required for in the application. And this clarifies that the maps and the GIS filed in an energy conversion facility siting application must include the location of the proposed facilities, the proposed site, and all the criteria, exclusion and avoidance areas, for example, that are evaluated in the application. The next proposed change is to section 6906.0401, subsection 3. Again, relating to the application. And this change eliminates the requirement for filing paper copies of a siting application except upon commission request. Our requirement was for the filing of 10 copies in the past. With this change, no copies would be filed except upon request. The next change is to section 6906.0501, subsection 2Q, also related to applications, the contents of the application. Again, the maps and the GIS requirements. And this change clarifies that the maps and the GIS filed in a transmission facility siting application must include the location of the proposed facilities, the proposed corridor and route, and the criteria evaluated, again, such as the exclusion and avoidance area criteria. The next change is a proposed change to 6906.0501, subsection 3, again related to the application. And this eliminates the requirement for filing paper copies of a siting application except upon commission request. The next proposed change is to section 6906.0502, subsection 5. And that is in the designation of a corridor and route, and in particular, the corridor width. This proposed rule change eliminates the requirement that a designated corridor for a transmission facility must be at least 10% of the facility length, but not less than 1 mile or greater than 6 miles, unless otherwise determined by the commission. And regarding otherwise determined by the commission's current practice is to designate corridor widths much less than 1 mile. For example, 200 feet is typical. And so this rule is ineffectual. The next proposed change is to
Could you repeat that?
Sorry. Go ahead.
Could you repeat that last one, please?
Sure. The rule affected or proposed changes to Rule 6906052, subsection 5, has to do with the designation of a corridor and route. And this would be the commission's designation of a corridor or route. And it's about the corridor width. This proposed change eliminates the requirement that a designated corridor for a transmission facility must be, in other words, the current requirement is that that designated corridor must be at least 10% of the facility length, but not less than a mile and not greater than 6 miles, unless otherwise determined by the commission.
Okay, that's what I thought. I misunderstood you before, so thank you.
We're eliminating that from the rule. Okay, so the next change is to section 6906.0801, subsection 3G. And this is energy conversion facility siting criteria avoidance areas. And what this proposed change does is adds to the list of avoidance areas for an energy conversion facility any areas within 2 nautical miles of the geographic center of an intercontinental ballistic missile launch or launch control facility. And the final proposed rule change is to section 6906.0802, subsection 2E. And this is related to transmission facility corridor and route criteria avoidance areas. And this proposed change clarifies that the avoidance area of 500 feet from a residence, school, or place of business may be waived by either the property owner or the controlling entity. A waiver by the controlling entity is most likely to occur for businesses or school locations, for example. And that concludes my description.
All right. Thank you, Pat. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Thank you, Pat. That's helpful. Could you clarify the distance on the ICBM stuff again, please? The setback.
Sure. I'll just read it back again. The proposed change is that areas within 2 nautical miles of the geographic center of an ICBM launch or launch control facility.
Okay, thank you. 2 nautical miles.
Correct. I think the first version of this, I had it at 1.5.
Right.
For some reason, that number stuck in my head, and then everybody else seemed to remember it was 2, so we changed it to 2.
Commissioner Christman, did you have any other clarifications or questions before I open it up?
Yeah, why are we eliminating the requirement that refunds not be done when they're less than $50? And maybe 50 is the wrong number, but I hate to think that sometime we're at the point where we spend a fair amount of money with the state's processes of issuing checks. You know, it requires hands-on from multiple people within the agency and costs us a fair deal of time for a check someday that's going to be a dollar or something like that. The tax department doesn't issue refunds below some certain amount. I know it's less than, their amount is certainly less than $50. So maybe $30, $40 refunds are important enough that they should go out and we have the wrong number in. But if we completely take this out, we could conceivably go through a big expense to issue a check for a dollar sometime.
Pat, did you want to take that one or you want me to?
Well, I can chime in and then you can chime in after that. But the discussion goes back sometime, quite a while back when we had our financial accountants said that we don't really have a choice of not refunding some money that belongs to the company that filed the money. That's the way our accountants saw it, was that this money belonged to the company, and even if there's $10 left over, that money needs to be refunded to the company because it belongs to them.
My understanding is that was driven by an audit finding during a past audit. It was before my time here, but that's my understanding, is that practice was in place during an audit that was called into question, so that's why we're changing it.
And I think there's at least some degree of agreement in terms of just the principle of the matter, in terms of it's not our money, even though it's a very small amount at times. But so that was a discussion point I remember is when we went through the various rules. But
I guess before I was focused on the ICBM stuff, and yeah, just I don't recall that discussion. So thank you for clarifying that.
Okay. All right.
And the paper copies, regarding the paper copies and completely eliminating that, I guess I think some folks still like to look at them by paper. So how are we going to handle that? Just as needed, request them, or just tell them we want two? Or
I would have to look. I wasn't 100% sure that we completely eliminated it. I couldn't remember if we reduced it or dropped it altogether.
It's eliminated.
I know the way it is right now. I'm just trying to think back through our previous discussions, because I know Commissioner Chrisman had, I think, raised kind of the same issue about liking the paper copies. So I will check back to make sure that it wasn't left at a certain number other than zero, but I'll make sure that's correct.
I thought it was three or two or something.
And I recall conversations that reducing from 10 to three, and then additional copies upon request. But just out of as a matter of procedure, at this stage, we're in the hearing process. We're introducing these for comments. What would the process be if we wanted to change it instead of no copies but to three copies? I realize this isn't the best time now at this stage of the game to have this conversation, but it's been raised, so that's the question I have.
Well, I guess I would check to make sure that the previous discussion is what we're moving forward. I think we could still have the conversation and make sure that whatever it is moving forward is accurate to what it was supposed to be. I don't know if I know, like in one of the other ones, the controlling entity language, I think the wrong version of that one got filed, so that will be corrected before moving forward.
I will say, Mr. Chairman, my recollection of how I thought this was going to play out was that, you know, it's probably hard to set this and have it right for every type of case that could be filed here. I know I have my preferences. Something like we're doing today, I prefer to have on the screen. And I don't know if copies were ever printed. If I didn't bother with them if they were, and it was kind of a waste. There are some other things where I prefer to have the paper copy. And as I go forward, if this becomes the rule, I guess I thought my intention was to make kind of hopefully clear to our public utilities staff what kinds of things I'll be expecting a paper copy on. Hopefully, since I expect a lot of the companies are listening today, that they, if this changes to zero, that they don't just take that as assuming we're going to come begging, because that's going to slow their process down. So I hope when they file things, they will check with public utilities to see about how many paper copies that we would want of whatever type of thing they're filing. And I'm going to kind of let my general requests be known to public utilities. Now, if we set a different lower number, then maybe I don't have to do that. But
I tend to believe that there's still adequate time to request written copies, which is a part of the verbiage that upon request we can see an application that does come in and we want paper copies X number. We also have the opportunity to print from the electronic version as many printed copies as we would like. In some cases, obviously, it'd be a lot of printing.
Yeah.
But either the company, you know, prints or we print, or they provide upon request. So I'm not exactly sure at the stage of the game where we would go from here if we would want to modify it at this stage of the game.
I'm sure Jack will show up if I misspeak here, but I believe that based on comments and conversation today, we are allowed to make changes to what's moving mm-hmm. forward.
What would be the preference be of Commissioner Fedorchuk, Commissioner Christman, to leave it as is or to have three copies, for example?
I mean, it might make sense, since we're going through the rule change, just take it out and then make the requests as kind of a standard thing that people, companies just follow what's requested, but there's no requirement baked into the rules for a certain number. Because I anticipate as we move forward, need for them is going to decrease.
Mm-hmm. And which I think is a very good move on the commission's part. We're receiving an abundance of printed copies, of which in some cases they were fully utilized, but in many, you know, maybe one or two or three copies or two or three were utilized. John, do you have some comments related to the question?
No, I just wanted to echo what Mr. Johnson stated regarding the opportunity to amend the rules. We do have the ability to do that subsequent to this hearing. This is our proposal and our reception of the comments. So especially for something administrative such as this, we would be able to make amendments prior to our submission to Legislative Council and the AG as well.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm supportive of the way it's currently written. I think we can always tweak it, make minor revisions later, but perhaps at this point a topic for more additional conversation going forward.
See what if anybody in the public cares.
Right. Okay. All right, then at this point in time, Pat, since there was a little bit of discussion, do you have anything further to add, or are you good on your end?
No, I have nothing further to add, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Pat. I will now open the hearing for comments. Does anyone wish to testify on case number PU-20-422 concerning the proposed rules? And Matt, I will turn it over to you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, we have three people on the queue. Two wish to be dialed in at the same time, so I'll give them a call first. They're Ryan Pumford and Tony Rock.
And which one would you like to go first, Matt?
Oh, I'm dialing them both right now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Good morning, this is Ryan Pumford. I'm on.
Oh,
Good morning.
Good morning, Lieutenant General retired Anthony Rock on the line.
Okay, thank you, sir. Please proceed.
All right, good morning, commissioners. As I said, my name is Ryan Pumford. I'm a director of development for NextEra Energy Resources, LLC, or NextEra. With me is Lieutenant General retired Tony Rock, who's a 35-year Air Force veteran with command and operational experience, with whom we consult to aid in engaging the right people within the DoD and ensuring our projects are compatible with the military mission. NextEra is one of the largest wholesale generators of electric power in the United States, with generating facilities in 36 states and Canada at the end of 2019. NextEra subsidiaries own and operate 15 wind projects in North Dakota and is currently constructing a 16th project that will be in service before the end of the year. In my role as Director of Development for NextEra, I'm responsible for overseeing the development of wind projects nationwide, which includes obtaining necessary permits and approvals, such as approvals from the Department of Defense and Federal Aviation Administration. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today to provide insights that NextEra has learned from developing its fleet of resources and from our experience working closely with the DoD and FAA to safely site wind turbines that may be near intercontinental ballistic missile or ICBM launch facilities or launch control sites. At NextEra, which has a 25% veteran workforce, myself included, we understand and respect the critical need for wind developers to coordinate closely with the Department of Defense, FAA, local military officials to ensure that wind development is compatible with the military's critical mission. Specifically, it was through this early outreach and close coordination that we were able to collaborate with Vance Air Force Base in Oklahoma to reach consensus on a project configuration of a 250-megawatt Skeleton Creek wind project. We also worked with F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming and the North American Aerospace Defense Command, or NORAD, to implement mutually agreeable radar mitigation strategies for projects in Wyoming, Oregon. Additionally, we've collaborated with the Kansas Air National Guard on a solution to mitigate the impact on one of their military training hubs. When we begin developing a new wind project, we reach out to any military installation within the vicinity of a proposed project, or we use airspace above a project to begin informal coordination, and we separately commence informal review of a proposed project by the DoD's Military Aviation and Installation Assurance Siting Clearinghouse, which I'll refer to as the Siting Clearinghouse. The Siting Clearinghouse was established in 2011 to review projects and assure that proposed wind developments are compatible with the military mission. The Siting Clearinghouse is responsible for contacting and coordinating with all military users of affected airspace, including local Air Force bases and ICBM launch or launch control facilities, and issuing an assessment of compatibility on behalf of all Department of Defense users. The Siting Clearinghouse informal review process engages all users of affected airspace and the developer to review each impact on a case-by-case basis. After our informal meetings and after making any necessary adjustments to the wind development, we begin a formal review process through the FAA, which reviews proposed turbine locations and ultimately issues the determinations of no hazard to ensure that turbines do not significantly impact airspace. As part of this formal review process, the FAA sends the application to the Siting Clearinghouse for its review on mission impacts. If individual issues are identified that weren't addressed through the informal review process, the wind developer works with a mitigation response team, which is comprised of the developer, the Siting Clearinghouse, and all impacted military units, in order to try and find a workable solution. If no mitigation is possible through the mitigation response team, then the Siting Clearinghouse would issue an objection, and NextEra would have to abandon the project. If the project is compatible with the military mission, the Siting Clearinghouse then clears the project, and the FAA, finding no further airspace issues, would issue the determination of no hazard. So we rely on the Siting Clearinghouse approval and the DNHs not only to ensure compatibility with the military mission and aviation, but we also are not able to finance and build turbines that don't receive approval. To our knowledge, no wind project has ever been built in locations to which the Siting Clearinghouse objected. For this reason, based on our experience, if the FAA, the Siting Clearinghouse, or other military leaders have concerns about turbine locations, These concerns are specifically addressed informally before requesting permits or formally through the siting clearinghouse process. Turbines that would interfere with the military's mission are not built. Therefore, NextEra respectfully submits that adopting a blanket 2-mile avoidance area setback is not necessary and would limit wind generation development in the state. Individual impacts are thoroughly assessed and addressed on a case-by-case basis by the siting clearinghouse, their informal and formal processes, so no further rule changes are necessary. If the commission does wish to modify its rules to include a 2-mile setback as an avoidance area, we would respectfully suggest that it include language that would allow the commission to waive the avoidance area if an applicant shows that it has received DNHs for its proposed wind turbines from the FAA or has obtained a mission compatibility letter from the DoD siting clearinghouse. This will allow the commission to ensure that the military's concerns are addressed without creating a blanket prohibition. NextEra is also concerned that, as currently drafted, the proposed rule could limit the construction of non-turbine infrastructure, such as underground collection facilities, access roads, or construction laydown yards within this 2-mile setback area. To address this concern, we would respectfully suggest that the Commission modify any language it adopts to make clear that any avoidance area applies only to vertical turbines and does not limit the construction of other non-turbine infrastructure, such as collection lines, access roads, laydown yards, et cetera. We are committed to working with the military to properly site wind projects that balance property owners' rights with preservation of national defense and security of our nuclear weapons. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. Lieutenant General Rock and I are happy to answer any questions you may have.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't have any questions. Commissioner Fedorchuk, any questions?
Thank you. I appreciate you both being here to discuss this. So I, to some extent, disagree with your statement that no wind facilities have been sited in areas where the military would prefer them not to be, because that's actually what triggered this discussion and this rule, is the existing of some of them that they feel are potentially hindering their operations and the security of some of the missiles. So in my mind, what this rule is intended to do is put the put the developers on notice that they really need to actively engage with the military on this issue. And doing nothing would keep it the way it has been, in which cases some companies, probably NextEra, being one of the most experienced in the nation in developing facilities, is probably well aware of this need. Other developers, that awareness might not be as common, and so it's a trigger to get to really stimulate that engagement and avoid what did happen with one project recently, which is after the fact the developers lost a number of the turbine sites that they had been pursuing, and it was a challenge for them in that project. So I think it's this, as I see it, is intended to help the process and avoid costly problems for developers. Now, I thought that the language offered a little bit of option for the military not requiring the 2-mile. I thought that's what we were settling on. So before I, before you answer, I want Brian Johnson, our attorney, to comment about that, and then I want to hear your thoughts on what I've just stated as kind of how I'm viewing this.
So the reason that it was put into the avoidance area rather than an exclusion area is because it does allow us to, at that point, without a built-in waiver or language like that, to make a decision, and that was based on the military's statement that they might not have, I think they would prefer an exclusion area. But as far as finding a middle ground and making this work for everybody, the decision was made to put it in the avoidance area so that when a tower, it would allow us to have towers built within that 2 mile area and, again, other facilities as well. I guess
yeah.
I didn't think about the language from that point. But it being in the avoidance area instead of exclusion allows for the possibility
right.
to have towers placed within that 2 miles.
Good. Thank you, Brian, for that reminder. That's now I remember. with if the company can show that there's no reasonable alternative, then it can go in the avoidance area. So I guess that's the balance that we're trying to create here. And I'd be interested in your comments on that.
Sure. Thank you, Commissioner Fedorchak. I don't disagree with you that that there are projects that are in locations that the military otherwise would prefer they not be. As I stated in my comments, the siting clearinghouse was created in 2011. There were a number of projects that were built before then. Additionally, mm-hmm. I think the siting clearinghouse, when they were created, and started communicating these projects on behalf of the DOD. Initially, I think left out Global Strike Command in that communication. So they were talking to installations with flying missions, talking about the airspace. And I think that's what led to projects being sited closer to ICBM facilities than Global Strike Command would have preferred. My understanding through our communications with 20th Air Force and with the DOD siting clearinghouse is that the clearinghouse now includes Global Strike Command in their informal and formal processes. And so that was the basis for my suggestion that a rulemaking here is not necessary, even for the little developers, not little, but the developers who might not be as sophisticated, they would still have to go through the FAA process, which includes a formal process conducted by the DOD siting clearinghouse. So getting to the point where they're taking a project through permitting, the developers would have had to talk to owners of the ICBM facilities.
And what requires that? Are you suggesting languages in our rule that would be different to suggest that requirement? Or is that, how do they know that they have to go through that clearinghouse?
The FAA handles that. So a developer would file with the FAA. As part of the FAA's process, they send the proposed turbines to a number of different agencies, including Department of Homeland Security, Department of Defense, and then internal FAA agencies, their flight standards office, their flight procedures office, seeking comment. When the siting clearinghouse receives a formal request from the FAA, they conduct their formal part of the process, which involves contacting everybody, all military units that have impacts, which includes 20th Air Force and flying units.
So
the statutory part from the FAA process.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I appreciate that and hope that that process is as kind of foolproof as you're describing, but it doesn't feel like the military is on the same page as you with that process being as seamless and comprehensive and, covering all the ground that they feel needs to be covered. And again, I think the two nautical miles is a lot and would not support it being an exclusion area because I think it just really rules out a lot of potential private land from wind development. So I don't think that's appropriate for us to be doing. But somehow we have to button this up so that there's a sure-fired way to have the military engaged in this and protecting those resources as well, those installations. So I hopefully they're on the call and going to be chiming in this morning too. But were you participating in the conversations with our staff? There was kind of a working group that discussed this. Did you guys participate in those?
We did. I wasn't personally in those conversations, but our company did participate.
And what's your sense of why this process that you're suggesting didn't end up being the solution that came out of that working group?
Yeah, I think the issue with the FAA and DoD clearinghouse process is that of a rogue developer that's intentionally not following the appropriate processes and concluding at great risk to themselves that they can build somehow without having the DoD's or the FAA's approval. So if the FAA issues a determination of no hazard, then that implies that the Department of Defense has signed off. The Department of Defense has to sign off in order for the FAA process to complete. So I don't know if I've answered your question very well. General Rock, do you have anything else you'd like to add here?
Well, thank you very much to all the commissioners. And let me say from the outset that NextEra Energy respects the critical mission of the Air Force and all the military services. They do want to work in a collaborative way to balance the needs of national security and the growing demands for abundant renewable energy, as well as the preservation of property rights of private individuals. I've been working with NextEra Energy now for 18 months to help them have more constructive dialogue with the Department of Defense and all the military services, and to help facilitate the meetings that the commissioner was referring to with local wing leadership. Then I will also tell you that I would not appear before you today after a lifetime of service in the Air Force specifically if I wasn't certain that NextEra Energy, which as Ryan said has a 25% veteran workforce, was fully and sincerely committed to supporting the mission of the armed services. So with all of that preamble, that is to say that I have been encouraged and impressed by the appetite of NextEra Energy executives all the way down to their developers to engage those local wing commanders, and for instance, in North Dakota, the 91st Missile Wing, at that colonel level, at the wing commander level, all the way up to headquarters, whether that's a numbered Air Force like the 20th Air Force led by Major General Lutton, or the Global Strike Command out of Barksdale Air Force Base, responsible for all of our Air Force nuclear assets, or even Air Force Headquarters, or the Department of Defense, the Office of Secretary of Defense. So to the point of whether or not all of the developers out there, regardless of the size of their capacity for development, are going to be as disciplined and dedicated to the process as NextEra Energy, as Ryan said, they are now, since 2011, are required to go through the Department of Defense clearinghouse to receive the, and through the FAA, to receive their determination of no hazard, or a DNH, before they can legally build. So there is a process that's in place. The 20th Air Force, the 91st Missile Wing, the Air Force Headquarters, and Global Strike Headquarters have a voice in the Department of Defense answer back to the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, who actually issues the department the determination of no hazard. And I'm not sure that that was always the case, and I think that's where, prior to this process being institutionalized, memorialized, and the Department of Defense dedicating assets to it, to include personnel in the clearinghouse, I think there were vertical obstructions built inside of the 2 miles. And when I say we, NextEra Energy, as well as the American Wind Energy Association representatives met with 20th Air Force headquarters in the this past winter, and we heard from their tactical experts why they needed the maneuver room around these both launch sites, the missile silos, but also their command and control sites. We fully understand that, but we believe that rather than a universal two-mile setback from all of those sites, that a case-by-case basis that goes through the clearinghouse process is the better solution. Certainly, a universal template makes things easier with regard to the burden of analysis that has to go on by a case-by-case basis. But we, as late as this September, NextEra Energy executives specifically, have had a virtual conference or a virtual call with Major General Lutton, the 20th Air Force commander, the higher headquarters above the missile wings. And Major General Lutton has showed great interest in continuing engagements from his level all the way down to the wing commander. So I think the process has been corrected and institutionalized and memorialized through the clearinghouse process. I think that there are probably case-by-case basis or conditions where some incursion inside of 2 miles could still be acceptable to the military without breaking their requirement and breaking their execution capability to defend the missile sites. So that's my take after working with NextEra Energy for 18 months and having the opportunity over the last year to work with the 20th Air Force headquarters to better understand their concerns. Let me stop there and see if you have questions specific for me.
Thank you. Thank you, General Roth. And let me start by thanking you for your career-long service to our nation's military and all the leadership that you obviously have provided. You no doubt saw a lot of action in your career, and I personally appreciate all of our service members a great deal. And now to be using your knowledge and connections to continue to serve the public and in your role, that's great. So I would feel very comfortable with the process that you guys are outlining here, and with an agreement coming forward to the folks that we're working with in the military in North Dakota, expressing the same. The problem that I, as I understand it, is that's not how they see it. And so we don't have universal acceptance that the process that you guys are outlining through the clearinghouse effectively allows our in-state military folks the input and notice and engagement with the developers that they feel that they need. So if I'm wrong in that, I would love to hear otherwise from folks. And I mean, I'm perfectly happy to sign off on that clearinghouse process if there's, you know, support across the board that's the way to go and that's a proper channel.
Commissioner Christman?
First, let's start with a real easy couple questions. Ryan, could you spell your last name, please?
Yes, Pumford, P as in Paul, U, M as in Mike, F-O-R-D.
And General, is your last name Rock, like R-O-C-K, or?
Yes, that's correct. I know you can't make up a name like that, but you've got it exactly right, R-O-C-K.
I thought it was Roth.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying, and as Commissioner Fedorchuk said, thank you for your service. Two things. Ryan, not necessarily all this question and answer stuff, but your original testimony, are you going to provide that in writing so that, like, for instance, the recommendations for tweaks to this we would have in your words as opposed to our notes?
Yes, sir. We're going to provide written testimony and expand on areas based on our conversation today.
Okay, thank you. And then lastly, General, you mentioned a universal template. And I'm just feeling like we kind of solved that problem by not going with this request for this setback as an exclusion area, but instead changing it to an avoidance area. If it was an exclusion area, I guess I would view it more as a universal template, that then that's just the area where we can't allow anything. But with the avoidance area, it seems to me that is more of dealing with it in a case-by-case basis. It simply means that the developer would have to show that there's not a reasonable alternative. If I'm understanding the explanation of the clearinghouse process, it probably sounds like, and for the most part, that may have been done in order to get approval from that clearinghouse. So that's not really a question, but something that you can, either of you can respond to. What is really a question is, can you clarify better for me exactly who makes up this clearinghouse?
Sure. First of all, let me say thank you very much for acknowledging my service. And when I get those comments, I'm always very appreciative. But I also am very quick to acknowledge the people who stand behind our people, that being the families that that often don't get the thanks and acknowledgement. So thank you very much for acknowledging my service. I appreciate that. And I always like to pass on your thanks and appreciation to our dependents, who we are so dependent upon. As to the clearinghouse actually is a function of the Office of Secretary of Defense, specifically comes under Secretary Henderson, who is in charge of logistics and infrastructure in the Office of Secretary of Defense. And it is made up of a number of government civil servants, many who have prior military experience. And importantly, the clearinghouse interacts with the military services. So the FAA effectively issues the planning notice or the planning request from companies to the different departments across the U.S. government. And today's discussion would be the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense then turns to the military services and says, we have this request. Do any of the military services, the Air Force, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, now Space Force, do any of the services have any objections? And then the services will then staff those questions or that question out to their subordinate commands. Specific to missile and nuclear ICBMs, it would go from the Air Force down to Global Strike Command headquarters, headquartered out of Barksdale, which is responsible for all nuclear issues, both manned aircraft as well as missiles. And then from Global Strike Command, the subordinate command that is responsible for missiles is the 20th Air Force, headquartered at F.E. Warren in Wyoming, F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. And then they have three subordinate missile wings under the 20th Air Force. And the one you would care deeply about is the 91st Missile Wing at Minot Air Force Base. Specific to your question, as far as the clearinghouse specifics, if you think of it as a function that is the Office of Secretary of Defense over the military services, that's the best way to think of it. Let me stop there and see if Ryan has anything to add as to the process from the industry perspective, and then I'll be ready to – I'd like to confirm that I've answered your question.
I mean, what we discussed from the industry perspective is we do a lot of informal outreach. The DOD has an informal process, and then the DOD has a formal process. And I think tying this in and maybe circling back to Commissioner Fedorchuk's question, why this is still being pushed, I can't speak for the military, obviously, but the issue that's come up is whether a developer could actually build turbines hypothetically without having an FAA determination of no hazard or without having a DOD clearance. Now, in North Dakota, they would not be able to because this commission wouldn't permit a project that didn't have FAA determinations of no hazard. Now, however, I just want to talk about the avoidance area a little bit. Let's say somebody does find a way to get through this without engaging the DOD, or with engaging the DOD, and we have this blanket avoidance area of 2 miles. So it is a very large setback that removes a good swath of North Dakota from being able to host wind turbine infrastructure. But the avoidance area criteria is to find, we're required to show that there's no reasonable alternative. And I think if I can suggest an alternative approach, which would be if you are going to stick with the avoidance area, then if we could include a waiver provision, one of the things I said in my opening comments was the DOD can issue what's called a mission compatibility letter. So if the commission adopts that as a waiver provision, a mission compatibility letter from the DOD confirms that the project proponent talked with the DOD and any other users of the airspace, including owners of ICBM facilities, and reached agreement. And that's done on a case-by-case basis, where an individual impact would be studied and approved by the ICBM facilities. And I think something along those lines, with a waiver, either a waiver by the DOD or just production of a DOD mission compatibility letter, I think would suffice.
So, Ryan, you're suggesting that would be what the companies would provide to basically build within the 2 mile step back and show that there's.
Yes, if a company.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, if a company is going to propose a turbine within 2 miles, then they would do so with their FAA determination of no hazard. And it's a little bit belt and suspenders approach, but DOD can also issue, and they've done this in the past, issue a mission compatibility letter for the specific turbines, indicating the DOD is okay with that particular impact.
All right. So that would take the place of our no reasonable alternative, basically.
Yes, that's what I'd suggest.
Yeah. Okay, and then to your point about the projects getting the, wouldn't be able to be permitted without the FAA no hazard determination. That's true. We always do have that. What we've heard, my understanding is that sometimes that happens without the input from our local military people. That's what they've, that's the issue that they're trying to address in bringing this to our attention.
Yep. And that makes sense. That's happened in the past. And to General Rock's comment, the DOD clearinghouse, through coordinating with 20th Air Force, has fixed that communication issue forward. General Rock, did you have anything else to add?
So I was going to say that Ryan did mention that initially when the clearinghouse stood up, it was focused primarily on hazards to flight, fixed wing and rotor wing flight. And no one was really, and this is my understanding, there wasn't as much or really any attention on both the impacts on radar, which quickly evolved to the, oh yes, we should think of that as well, radar degradation, but also the impacts on nuclear missile site, specifically missile site security. When you talk to the 20th Air Force operational and tactical experts about why they have come on the net and said they really want 2 miles around all the sites, is it's got to do with their ability to react to ground threats to those sites with helicopter-borne security forces. So that's to say that the clearinghouse now, and the, as my understanding is, the Air Force headquarters now looks at the impact not just on flight, but also on impacts on radar degradation and impacts on security of nuclear missile sites. If the wing commanders and the 20th Air Force commander still don't believe their voice is being heard, then we're, you know, fully supportive of the Air Force headquarters making sure that all of the voices of the nuclear experts are heard. So, you know, I think we're in agreement that the 20th Air Force and specifically the missile wing commanders need to have their vote in this. And it's up to Air Force headquarters to then voice their concerns from the missile experts to the clearinghouse. So I think the problem has been identified within the Department of Defense in that the missile folks weren't always being heard. Why that happened? The function of first focus on flight aviation, but I think now that Global Strike Command, 20th Air Force, and the missile wings are getting their voice, it doesn't reset the clock for things that happened before, but that's my understanding of it.
Thank you, General Rock. Is it unrealistic to think that the higher-ups to the missile wings here could intervene and say, we understand what their concerns are, and we agree they need to be addressed and feel that they have been fixed through this clearinghouse process, so this, you know, so that basically to reinforce what you guys are saying here, that this clearinghouse process is the solution and the Air Force recognizes it and follows it. It seems like there should be a higher up authority to the local people that could confirm that for us and basically say, you know, we overrule them, for lack of a better word.
So anything I say about that would be speculation in that I am now retired, but I think that's a valid question to ask the military as they testify or as you have continuing consultations with them. I think what you're, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're asking is it possible that the missile wing commanders could say at their level, hey, this is going to significantly degrade our mission, and their higher headquarters, or maybe even the headquarters above that, might say, I've heard you, but we don't see it that way, so we're not going to object. Is that
well,
what you're asking?
Not really. What I'm suggesting is we're just trying to settle on a process here. And so whether we need to add this to our avoidance areas or whether the clearinghouse effectively addresses this, our local military want this as an exclusion or avoidance area. And you guys, you know, the industry is essentially saying the FAA process and this clearinghouse process works and the military recognizes it. Well, there's a chain of command higher than the North Dakota military installations that should be able to step in and say, sorry, guys, in North Dakota, we recognize what you're saying, but we have this process, and this is the process, and this is where these issues are to be addressed. Then we don't need to be advocating for additional exclusion areas in law.
So that next higher headquarters above the 91st Missile Wing at Minot is the 20th Air Force, which is responsible for all nuclear missiles in the Air Force specifically. And their next higher headquarters is Global Strike Command. I don't disagree with you. We've had some initial consultations telephonically and through a virtual engagement with Major General Lutton, the relatively new two-star commander of 20th Air Force. He has not indicated that he disagrees with his subordinate missile wing commanders at this point. So I think this is, you know, I think it's a continuing consultation we have. As what Ryan talked about with a letter of mission compatibility, in some ways that's redundant to the existing clearinghouse process. But if that gives the local military commanders and their next higher headquarters, the 20th Air Force, a greater sense of confidence that their voice is being heard, then, I'll leave it to Ryan, but I think that's what he was suggesting. And that is a confidence-building measure, I would say, and a compromise to make sure that the local military commanders below the level of headquarters Air Force in the Pentagon feel like they are getting every opportunity for their voice to be heard and to make an impact in the final decision.
Yeah, so it sounds like that's a good question to ask your local military leaders if they're providing oral testimony. But that the staff at the site and clearinghouse could certainly opine and tell you, you know, the communication chain that led up to this and how well the process works. But the local military leaders could also confirm.
Well, Ryan, thank you very much for your comments. General Rock, again, thank you for your service and also recognition of the family members that support each individual who serve in the military. I think that's incredibly appropriate and a very appropriate, again, thing to recognize. So thank you for that. At this point in time, I would very much like to hear comments from if we do have someone who will be testifying from the 20th Air Wing to see what their thoughts are on the discussion so far, because I think that would be very helpful for me. But prior to doing that, I would like to take a 5-minute recess. I believe it was identified as a convenience break yesterday. So a short 5-minute recess, and just to be safe, looking at the clock now, at approximately 11:27, we will reconvene. So we are in recess until then.
Okay,
welcome back, everyone. We are reconvened for case number PU-20-422, Energy Conversion Facility Siting Criteria, and we will take the next individual who would like to provide input. Matt, I will turn it over to you again.
Okay. Next on our list we have is Wells McGriffith from Elite Clean Energy.
Can you say the name again, Matt, please?
Wells McGiffert. Giffert, excuse me. Giffert.
Mm-hmm. It'd be helpful if the people that testify would spell their name. Sometimes it's kind of hard to hear clearly.
Exactly.
And again, just another reminder, as stated at the beginning of the proceeding, if you do have a prepared statement, a written copy of your statement, in addition to your verbal testimony, will be appreciated and helpful. So, Wells, do we have you on the line?
I'm just dialing them now, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right.
Hello, Mr. Wells?
Yes. Good morning.
Okay. Could you quickly spell your name for the commissioners, please?
Absolutely. Yep. First name is Wells, W-E-L-L-S. The last name is McGiffert, M-C-G-I-F-F-E-R-T.
Okay. Thank you.
And good morning, commissioners. As I said, my name is Wells McGiffert. I'm Vice President of Business Development for Elite Clean Energy. And I think we had a very, very good discussion. I appreciate our friends at NextEra for sharing, a very thorough and detailed, explanation of the process. Repeat or build on what they already said, I figured I would share comments specific to 69-06-08-016 for the 2 mile setback, and as it relates to a specific project, and kind of how the process, how we feel the process that's currently in place is working, as a means to, kind of help understand, how the process is working. We understand that there may be situations where there's been challenges, but do want to share kind of a real life example. Elite Clean Energy recently acquired the Russo Wind Project. And as we evaluated this project and the acquisition, the key thing for us was strong landowner, community, and stakeholder support and key engagement when it came to permitting, including working with the FAA and the DOD. The site application for the Russo Wind, which is case number PU-19-28, is currently in abeyance while we work through light mitigation strategies. What I wanted to share, though, is that the project conducted extensive engagement with the FAA, the DOD, and the local Minot Air Force Base. And the process included, sharing a number of layouts, gaining feedback from the DOD and the local Air Force Base. The turbines were shifted a number of times. We eliminated several turbine locations. And we ended up with a 1,200-foot setback requirement that met the needs of the operations near the ICBM missile silos. And we received in kind of the formal process as outlined by the team at NextEra, we did receive the determination of no material impact on military operations, and also the FAA's determination of no hazard. And so this was an extensive process, and it was with full engagement, and it was ahead of any of the permitting, kind of final permitting activities as the project was seeking its North Dakota approvals. The proposed rule change requiring the 2 mile avoidance from the ICBM would have a material impact, or potentially would have a material impact. We reevaluated, and with that requirement, it would eliminate roughly 34 turbines, or roughly two-thirds to 70% of the turbines in the project boundaries that are currently in the permitting process. We feel that, we did address the concerns directly. We, as I said, changed the layout, eliminated turbines, and it was very, kind of micro-siting that was done to do this to ensure that approaches and the operations were not going to be impacted. We believe that the consultation that's required and established through the FAA and the clearinghouse and local engagement, worked in this case. Our concern is that with establishing the, the 2 mile avoidance area, it may reduce flexibility for the commissioners and stakeholders. I think these projects are complex. It's not as simple as, trying to put dots. There's a number of factors that go into this. And I do believe that, most, if not all, developers of wind are responsible. They want to do the right thing. And, us at Elite Clean Energy and others, are fully committed to doing that. I think we would suggest is, the consultation requirement versus putting in a full avoidance requirement. And, I just wanted to share the experience does work. It is working in North Dakota. And it, our biggest concern is that if this is applied, the Russo Wind Project is located in an area in North Dakota that's in need of, economic development. It's sited near two existing wind projects, and we do have community landowners and alike providing strong support. And we feel that the process that's currently in place does work, and consultation is working. I kind of had a lot more to talk about, but I think NextEra did a great job going through the whole process. But I just wanted to share kind of the particulars around a specific project that can maybe provide how the consultation is working and potential impacts of creating an avoidance area. All right, happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, thank you, Wells. I have one question. Do you have a written statement that would expand upon the comments you just made verbally that would perhaps be the same in nature as General Rock and the NextEra Representative Ryan provided?
Yes, we will submit a written statement that kind of outlines very similar to what the folks at NextEra shared. And then also kind of as I mentioned, some of the examples around the Russo Wind Project. So we will be submitting a written statement to support that.
Okay. Could you, and I realize you weren't in on the, at least I don't believe you were, on the initial conversation with local Air Force representatives, but really what triggered this discussion was their concerns that they raised after a process had moved forward quite substantially to the point of having a siting application submitted to the commission. Am I misinterpreting that there was a breakdown, or was that just the fact that the process was still occurring at that point in time?
I'm not aware that there was a concern or a breakdown. Was the complaint or concern raised specific to the Russo Wind project, or was it a separate or a different case number?
I would be referring to the Russo, and before I go any further down this road, Brian, are we okay to have this conversation, or are we getting too specific on another case? And if we need to err on the side of caution, we can just do this through other means.
I guess so far I'm not uncomfortable with where the conversation has got. That case is in abeyance, but I don't see why we can't continue to use it as an example.
Okay.
So.
It just, the concerns that were raised after the application had gone through the various processes and informal discussions, et cetera, and it didn't seem that the original process, in my opinion, addressed military concerns, operational concerns that the military had, and then it's led to this point with this particular rule change.
What I should clarify too is Russo, that project does not, and I guess as far as I know and has never been discussed, had an issue with tower location and these facilities. What the local military brought to us from the Air Force up there and the 20th Missile Command was that in previous projects, and it wasn't in Russo, and I can't even remember if the example was in North Dakota or not, but there are some sites that have been completely ringed in by wind towers that prevent the ability to defend them with helicopters. So I don't know that Russo is I know that that one, as far as the discussions I've been a part of, have never had tower location as an issue.
Wasn't there a line of sight issue with having at least a 30-foot corridor between the tips of two blades on different turbines. Wasn't that an issue?
I believe that was in a previous rulemaking. That's just line of sight of communication from launch control facilities to ICBM sites and other launch control facilities.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Wells, I'm remembering this the same way as Commissioner Crosius. I think that there were, my memory is that the Russo project was kind of the project that triggered this engagement. It was after that project that the Air Force came to us asking for this, this setback and expressing concerns about the lack of coordination with them and the growing development of wind facilities in and around ICBM missile sites. And so maybe it was just, you know, Russo was just kind of the last straw. They thought, geez, this is just getting too much, or whether they thought that the process on that facility didn't go well. I'm not sure what it was, but it was shortly thereafter that we began to have this conversation about the setback that they would like from the ICBM. So I continue to, I'm open to this clearinghouse being the solution, but I really feel like it's incumbent upon the industry to get the military folks on board with that and bring that solution to us, to get the higher-ups in the in the state folks, and then the 20th, was it the 20th missile wing or 20th missile wing, to agree that the clearinghouse process can work, and whatever needs to be changed there to improve the input of the local folks, and then negate the need for a 2 mile of setback and avoidance areas. That I'm very open to that, but I think that is something the industry needs to take the lead on helping make happen.
This is Lieutenant General Rock, retired. I'd like to just clarify to make sure the record is correct. The 20th Air Force is a numbered Air Force headquarters. They are the higher headquarters above three missile wings, including the 91st missile wing at Minot Air Force Base. So for the record, it's 20th Air Force headquarters, which is the higher headquarters for the 91st missile wing at Minot Air Force Base.
Thank you, General.
Okay. Wells, do you have anything further to add? Or Commissioner Christman, do you have any questions before I turn it back to Wells to see if he has any comments?
I do not have any other questions.
Wells, do you have any other comments?
No, and thanks, Commissioner Fedorchuk. I appreciate the background. What I would say is I think, Elite and Elite Clean Energy, we're a very responsible organization. We've done a number of projects in North Dakota. We've got significant investment in North Dakota. On top of that, we do have a strong track record working with the military, both from coordination and then also from an employment standpoint. So we do take military operations, the individuals, and hold them in highest esteem. So I think you're right. The challenge, and we certainly didn't understand, if there was a problem. We still engage Capital Airspace, which is an organization that regularly engages with the, through the clearinghouse, and they've been working on this project, kind of from day one. And I don't believe there was any feedback, direct feedback, that the, previous project owner received or Capital Airspace that shared that, Russo was the straw that broke the camel's back, or that the local military, viewed this as kind of the reason why the process isn't working. I've reviewed the files. I've talked with all of the stakeholders and folks that were involved, and I understood it, and they still convey it, is that it was a very positive interaction. So I just wanted to share that you know, they may have certain feelings, and I don't know if it's just fatigue from, you know, there's more wind being built, and but it's not our understanding, our intention, that RUSA would be, you know, kind of this challenge that, you know, that's creating problems. We do engage early and often, and we are responsible, and we'll continue to do so. You know, I just want to convey that, but I do appreciate the feedback. And as I shared, we'll provide written statements, and you know, happy to engage further on this topic. Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Wells. I don't know if we have any other questions. No. Brian or Pat, I haven't checked in with you. Do you have any questions of Wells?
I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Wasn't there another caller?
We'll go to the next caller. I just wanted to make sure that no specific questions for Wells. Brian?
No questions.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Matt, do we have anyone else that is on the line?
Nobody in the call queue, but anybody dialed into the public bridge who would wish to make a comment, dial *9 for a virtual hand raise. Seeing none, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Still, and I guess we had, you know, two different mechanisms, but I think at least two and perhaps three of us in terms of the commissioners would very much like feedback from representatives from the 20th Air Wing, if that's correct, not to presume, but I believe that's what I heard from you,
Air
Commissioner
Force HQ.
Commissioner Fedorchak, correct, or Commissioner Chrisman, but I think that's an essential element and really bringing this together and then being able to make a good determination at that point in time. Commissioner Chrisman?
Or in the alternative, they've been here and testified, and if mm-hmm. if they don't retract or alter their testimony, I take it to mean that they meant what they said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just... there's quite a lot of conflicting information here. So.
And potentially new.
It often happens. I'm sorry.
Oh, and potentially I would have to go back and reread their testimony, but there could quite possibly be some conflicting information that was presented today.
They didn't testify on this rule. They testified on a different rule. So, I mean, can we take what was said on a different rule and apply it to this one? I mean, they should be here testifying on this.
But they testified on a desire for setbacks of 2 nautical miles.
Yeah.
Or more, even. And, you know, I don't think it's odd that there's conflicting testimony. And, you know, often in when we have specific citing cases and a potentially a county or a school district really wants it, we often hear from the developers, you know, it's local control. You know, don't get in the way of what these local people want. And there just are sometimes natural conflicts between what the higher-ups want and what the locals want. And in this case, it may be that the people at Minot who are overseeing the day-to-day safety of their own personnel and their own facilities view it differently than what the Pentagon views it in Washington, D.C. You
know. Right. And I certainly don't want to put local military representatives on the spot either, because there is a chain of command that they are required to follow and follow respectfully. So I certainly don't want to put them on the spot, but for any representatives listening, we will give another opportunity for any verbal comments at this point in time, or a reminder that you would have until December 4th to provide any written comments and testimony to the commission that would be considered as a part of our decision and the decision-making process. So, Matt, why don't we check one more time to see if there's any other individual who would like to testify at this point in time.
Once again, if you would like to provide some comments, dial star 9. Seeing none.
Okay. And Commissioner Christman, I do appreciate the comment that you made in terms of prior testimony and whether they wish to provide any additional comments at this point in time. So, a very good point. Okay, Matt, no one? All right. I don't have any other questions. Mr. Fawn or Mr. Johnson, do you have any other comments?
This is Pat. No questions or comments. Thank you.
Nothing here.
Okay, and one more time, Commissioner Fedorchak.
No more. Thank you for your testimony today for those who participated. It's helpful.
Okay. Commissioner Christman.
This information is really useful. Appreciate everybody's time today, and have a good Thanksgiving, everyone.
Yep. And I would certainly echo the comments of my fellow commissioners. I will now close the hearing on case number PU-20-422. All of the comments providing in writing through the close of business on December 4th, 2020 will be considered and discussed in our decision. Also, any changes made to the proposed rules due to the Commission's review of comments received or the Commission discussion will be explained in the written decision. The record again will remain open until December 4th, 2020. Have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone. The hearing is now closed.